Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Welcome to the first ever radio show focused just on breakthrough solutions. For 20 years, I've been on a treasure hunt, finding the best of what's working in America. I'm convinced that we've solved most of our social problems already, that someone somewhere has a solution. Often these solutions live as isolated models of what's possible, but are not well known or widely implemented. If we would identify and learn from these breakthrough solutions, we could dramatically improve the quality of life for millions of people, for billions of dollars less than we currently spend. I've found innovators who have developed breakthrough solutions in many areas, nine of which are profiled in my new book, Breakthrough Solutions. On this radio show, I'll invite a series of guests who will show you that seemingly impossible problems actually already have workable solutions. When we identify and build on these breakthrough solutions, we can create the world of our dreams in our lifetime. My first guest to launch the show is Ron Kaufman. As a child, Ron was diagnosed with severe autism and recommended for lifelong institutionalization. Instead, his parents developed the Sunrise Program, which enabled Ron to completely recover from his autism with no trace of his former condition. Ron went from being severely autistic to becoming a graduate of the Ivy League's Brown University with a degree in biomedical ethics. His parents founded the Autism Treatment Center of America to help other families dealing with autism. Ron became the CEO of the Autism Treatment Center of America and its sister organization, the Option Institute, and more recently became its Director of Global Education, devoting himself to helping other families dealing with autism and to helping people overcome seemingly impossible challenges. His new book on autism treatment will be coming out in early 2014. I chose Ron Kaufman as my first guest for this series on breakthrough solutions because his life is testimony to the fact that it is possible for some children to recover completely from autism. And the lessons learned from how he did that can help not only families dealing with autism, but all parents raising their children, and in fact can help all of us to live happier, more fulfilling lives. Ron Kaufman is here today to talk with us about overcoming autism and other seemingly insurmountable life challenges. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I am so excited you're here to launch this whole series on breakthrough solutions. How perfect is that?
I know. I'm really, really honored. It's the first show. I can't believe it.
So listen, I want to start, you know, you and I have met years ago and know each other a bit. I would love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about your story.
Sure. Well, yeah, here's what happened. It's amazing to me even now to think about it, because as a young boy, I was diagnosed with autism. And when I say autism, I'm talking about a really severe case. So what this meant in practice was I had absolutely no language at all, no communication, no eye contact with my parents or anyone else. I was very much enveloped in my own world. I would spend hours and hours every day doing repetitive behaviors, which is very common to people with autism, such as I would rock back and forth, flap my hands in front of my face. I would do this over and over again for hours. And my parents were told, look, he has a really severe case of autism. He has an IQ of less than 30. Autism is a permanent, lifelong condition, so you're going to really have to accept this, and when he gets a little older, you know, find a facility or an institution to put him in where he can be properly taken care of. So they were really handed down this pretty incredible and intense prognosis, which today parents are still often given very similar prognoses. And what my parents did was something really amazing in the face of that, which was they really turned their backs on these dire predictions, and they took me home, and they developed their own home-based, very much child-centered program where they worked with me for a little over 3 years. And at the end of that period, as you know and as your listeners could probably guess, I ultimately recovered completely from my former autism. So, you know, without any trace, I've just, like, lived a completely normal life. And so for me, this really shows me what's possible for our kids, and actually for a lot of other conditions that are often labeled hopeless or permanent or, you know, unsurmountable.
That's an amazing story, and I've gotten to know you and your parents some, because I had a daughter who had a lot of challenges, not autism, but some other challenges. And, you know, we know out there there's this dramatic rise in autism. The recent stats I saw a couple of years ago put it at about 1 in 110 young people have autism. And on a show last week with the co-host Charlene Spretnik, she mentioned she had heard it was as much as 1 in 50 children now has autism. And for so many of these children and their families, the prognosis is not great. And the treatments that are out there, generally speaking, seem not to be very effective. So I'm looking at you, and you're such an amazing being, and you came from that very, you know, profound autism situation to be this wonderful, articulate, charming, lovely, wonderful person. So what was it that your parents did that was so different from what the general approach to autism treatment?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate that.
Sure.
So my parents did some things that were such a dramatic departure from what was being done at the time, and is still a dramatic departure from what is done right now. And what they did, you know, there were several things that really separated what they did. First of all, obviously, just the fact that it was a program created by parents already set it apart. It wasn't created in a lab, wasn't created by doctors. It was created by parents actually on the front lines trying to help their own child. Mm-hmm. But more than that, it really focused on, it really saw what autism was, which was a difficulty in connecting with people and in communication, versus what it was normally treated as, which is a behavioral disorder where we have to stamp out the autistic behaviors and promote, in quotes, the normal behaviors. And so what my parents did was, instead of trying to force me to conform to a world that I didn't yet understand, they started by joining me in my own world first. That was where they began.
Fantastic. Well, you know, I've noticed this in so many of the breakthrough solutions in different areas. The people who are the innovators and come up with the more effective ways of doing things often do it. It's not an incremental change from what the kind of general approach is. It's actually a dramatically different approach. So right now, for example, so much of how autism programs go is exactly what you're saying around, you know, treating it as a behavior disorder and trying to do behavior modification, which I know the intentions are good, but I've seen some of these programs, and they actually sometimes can border on cruel for the children. You know, it's not that they're choosing to behave badly, in our view. You know, as you talk about, there's some difficulty in communication there. And one of the other aspects that I love about your parents and the whole approach they take is this idea about surrounding yourself and the child with unconditional love, and to know that everybody is doing the best they can given who they are and what they've experienced. And how important do you think that approach is in dealing with the autism?
Oh my gosh, it's so important and so deeply underrated and underappreciated. I mean, one of the things I most love about the program, not only from my own experience but from working with other kids, is that it's so honoring and respectful of the kids. But rather than just being honoring and respectful but not accomplishing anything in terms of actual progress, it has the best of both worlds. It is really respectful, really loving, really caring, really understanding of the kids, and yet the children really respond to it. And I'm talking about children from, you know, over 80 different countries over the last 30 years with all different severities of diagnosis. And, you know, it's amazing for me to think about, because remember when I said my parents started by joining me in my own world? So
yes.
Since when I was rocking back and forth and flapping my hands in front of my face, my mother would sit down next to me and do the same thing with me. And people said to her, this is a terrible idea. You're going to actually make it worse. You're going to make mm-hmm. him do more of this.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened in practice, and what we've now seen with thousands of kids over the last three decades, is that it never makes the child do the behavior more. It has the reverse effect, which is the more we join children in what they're doing, the children on the autism spectrum, the more they actually look at us, become interested in us, include us in their play. The first time I ever looked at my mother, ever played with her, ever smiled at her, was when she was joining me in what I was doing. And that's where they started, which has this, one of the things that's conveying to the child is exactly what you just said, Eleanor, which is that sense of, hey, I'm not trying to change you right now. I just want to be close to you. I love you exactly the way you are. I'm just interested in what you're interested in, and I just want to bond with you over what you most love and what you're most interested in. And the funny thing about this is this, it may be in a sense new to autism, but it's not new to human interaction. Like, this is how human beings have been forming relationships for thousands of years, and yet with the disorder that is most in need of help with relationship building, the way most of these children are helped are, in a sense, with antisocial principles.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's so spot on. And, you know, I found out about the Autism Treatment Center of America and you and your story because my husband and I adopted a young girl. She was 5 years old, who had extreme challenges, and not autistic, but had a very rough beginning and early trauma in her life, and was just, you know, an extremely difficult, almost kind of wild child. And in fact, the state that we adopted her from figured she couldn't make it in a regular family. So, and their plan was to institutionalize her, but you know, what I said to a friend of mine, I said, well, you know, we need a miracle. We need something that's going to help us help Veronica, you know, heal and be whole and happy person. And they said, oh, a miracle. Well, I know this place. It's, you know, the Autism Treatment Center of America, and they call it a place of miracles. And I went out and checked it. I couldn't, you know, it sounded too good to be true. But I drove out there to Sheffield, Massachusetts, and I met with the staff of the program for about 3 hours and learned all about you and your story and your family and the approach they had. I went, this makes so much sense. So right on this point, when they advised me, they said, you know, stop trying to force Veronica into your world and connect with her in her world. So what she had been doing, she loved to jump, so, you know, she jumped on my bed, my beautiful maple bed, and broke it. And she loved to jump on everything, so she was jumping on my couch one day, and I was ready for it, because what I had done was, based on the advice of go into her world, not yours, when she jumped on my couch, I took her by the hand, and I had gotten this little trampoline. So I put the trampoline in the living room, and I said, Veronica, jumping, what a great idea. So when instead of being a policeman saying, no, stop, don't, I became someone who was connecting with her and having fun with her. I said, come with me, we'll jump together on the trampoline. And that's what we did, and it turned something that would have been kind of a hostile, negative experience where I would feel bad and she would feel bad and my couch would be destroyed, into kind of a playful, fun exchange. And that whole approach just totally transformed our relationship and gave Veronica the foundation to turn her life around and become a much more healthy, happy young girl.
Wow, that's such a cool story. Yeah, and I'm you know, not surprised to hear it, because this is the crux of where relationships come from. And also, by the way, Eleanor, kind of cool is, so once we've done that with, you know, the kind of thing you just talked about with Veronica, what we've done with our kids, is it opens up a lot of possibilities. Then we can actually, for instance, in the Sunrise program, we do different games and activities that are based on each child's own interests and motivations. And those are the activities where we really focus on stretching their socialization, their skill level, their interactive abilities, all those kind of things. But what we find is that the brain is so much more plastic when a child or an adult is not in a state of fear or resistance or anything like that. And that's why, by creating that relationship and that sense of trust, we're not just creating the relationship, we're also creating so much more of a potential for growth and learning and change.
You know, and isn't that so true for all of us, not just the children with autism? I mean, don't we all learn and grow our best when we're not in a state of fear and anxiety?
Oh my gosh, that is so true. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the other, you know, one other thing that we do in the Sunrise program that is another really overlooked area is, you know, we have this program, just as an example, we have this program called the Sunrise Program Startup, where people come to our center in Sheffield, Massachusetts, and we have like a kind of a 100-acre campus, almost like a college campus. So parents and professionals come there. They come there for about 5 days, and they learn all of the, you know, aspects of the Sunrise Program. They can take that home with them. Now, the reason I tell you that is because people think when they come, oh, it's going to be 100% just learning all of these techniques. And indeed, we do spend a heck of a lot of time teaching them these kinds of techniques to do with their kids. But we also spend an enormous amount of time working with the parents and the professionals on their own emotions and attitudes about it, because of exactly what you just said. Because they can't actually learn new things, and they certainly can't be effective therapists and advocates and workers with their children when they're in a state of stress and anxiety and agitation.
Right. Absolutely. You know, when I went out to the Autism Treatment Center of America, I was asking things like, well, what do I do? What's the technique? And the very first lesson that I was taught was, said, well, it's, you know, we'll be happy to talk to you about that. But what's far more important and the place we want to start is your attitude. If you're looking at your child as a problem, or, you know, difficult, or you're feeling bad about yourself or them because, you know, instead of them being the child that's the star performer in school, this is the child that's the problem child and getting into fights. And my own daughter, for example, literally decking the principal, and her, when she was in the first grade, she whacked at the principal and knocked her to the ground. So, you know, these are not sometimes kids that you feel you can be proud of, and we can feel embarrassed about them. So the very first thing I needed to learn, which was so helpful to me, was how important the attitude, my attitude, is to know she's doing the best she can given who she is and what she's experienced. And if my attitude towards her is that she's a problem, then already she's feeling that at some very deep level. And she's not going to engage with me as a parent or as a teacher or as a coach. She's going to be like shut down to me. So when I made that shift was, I think, the most powerful shift in my parenting relationship with my daughter.
Wow. That's profound. And you know what, what that actually speaks to? It's so interesting hearing you say that, because one of the things, and I, by the way, not only interesting hearing you say it, but really cool of you to really own that's what you were going through, and that, yes, some parents do feel embarrassed about their children or upset with their children, frustrated. But one of the things we talk about, too, which is why this idea of attitude and the underlying beliefs and perspectives that create our attitude is so important, is what almost all parents do, and we have for instance, we have a parenting course just for parents with neurotypical children, and a big thing that comes up for them is that my child is a reflection of me. What my child is doing tells me what kind of parent I am. It tells me if I'm a good parent, tells me if I'm a bad parent, even possibly tells me if I'm a good or a bad person. Mm-hmm. And because of that, of course, parents' self-esteem is deeply wrapped up in what their kids are doing. So the key thing that we start by helping them with is to really get that actually, of course, you love your child, you want to help your child, but your child is not actually a reflection of you. Your child is their own person. They're going to do their own things no matter how you bring them up. And so this idea of attaching your own okayness as a parent to what your child is doing is super crippling for any parent, and it's a very normal thing for any parent to feel. And so when parents can start to separate that out, when they can still want to help their children grow and change, but without feeling like their own parenting is on the line and their own okayness is on the line, it helps them be so much more effective, so much more outside the box. And what you said, their children don't then react against their attitude so much, so they can be much more effective.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it was interesting to me to see. I mean, you yourself have made a dramatic recovery. I mean, from profoundly autistic to this, you know, wonderful, articulate, incredible being that you are. And I know thousands of families have come to you and to your parents to say, help us know what you did so we can help our child. And, you know, there's a lot of skeptics out there, and they would say, well, you know, well, maybe this was one spectacular exception, but, you know, do you have any sense? I know it's hard to be completely scientific about it, but of the thousands of families who have come to you for help at the Autism Treatment Center of America, what percentage of them would you say are helped, you know, somewhat or a lot by the Sunrise program?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, many people ask that. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, and I know this might sound funny, but strange as this may sound, there really isn't an autism program that exists in the world that can give you the perfect comprehensive statistics on the total number that have gone to X, you know, children that have progressed X much, because all the programs are being done, even the Sunrise program, people do it for a different number of hours per week. People do it for different lengths of time. The children are really different. They're starting at different ages. All different things are changing. So I don't have like a comprehensive percentage rate. It's 75% X. However, let me say this. We went through many, you know, we're a nonprofit organization. So typically we spent our money, you know, we would focus on raising money and spending all that money on financial aid for parents and for other people to help them be able to help their children. But one of the things we did do a few years ago was we got some donations that enabled us to start to get the ball rolling and ultimately contact universities to get some research done on the Sunrise program. We had Northwestern University in Chicago and Lancaster University in the United Kingdom do two separate studies. And actually, it's been really exciting and really heartening. We had a short-term study that showed, compared to a control group, the children who were worked with in the Sunrise program had gigantic leaps in their how they were interacting socially. And then we had a longitudinal six-month study that followed children over time. And again, compared to a control group, the people doing the Sunrise program over 20 hours a week really saw dramatic increases in two areas. A sociability scale that, by the way, wasn't measured by our scales. It was measured by an independent scale. And secondly, verbal communication and speech. So this is the kind of thing we're excited about. We'd like to actually have more of these kind of studies done.
I can tell you
from my own experience, just real quick, is that every child progresses differently. We've had children, a bunch of children, who've recovered just like me, and we've also had a whole host of children we've worked with who have made really amazing progress but have absolutely not recovered. So what I think, you know, every child's going to get to a different place. I never make a promise in advance to a parent. But what I do say is, we're never going to decide in advance what your child is not going to do. We want to give your child every chance.
Very good. And I'm just thinking here, you know, this is such a difficult situation for so many parents, you know, have kids somewhere on the autism spectrum. And, you know, I've talked to the parent. I had a hard time with our situation, but I think it's far more challenging for a lot of these parents who have children with autism. I mean, even thinking you've got a child right there and the child cannot look you in the eye and the mother has never heard her child say, "I love you, Mom." What can you say to our listeners today who are parents of children with autism? Speak right to that mother, and what would you say to her?
Well, oh my gosh. I mean, I'll just speak to any moms or dads listening out there and just tell you your love and your caring for your child cannot possibly be matched. I'm talking about you as a parent. And so no matter what anyone tells you, someone who has much more distance from your child tells you, they're not you. They don't have the kind of love and dedication, commitment that you have, that even the knowledge of your individual child that you have. No one can match that. So give yourself a chance. There, you know, any predictions that are made about your children are literally wild guesses. Keep in mind that before me, 0% of children recovered from autism. So this is something that there's so much you can do. We can help you. But either way, just know there is absolutely no such thing as something like false hope. Hoping can only be helpful. Believing in your child can only be helpful. And I'm much more concerned about false pessimism, about people making predictions about your child when your child's 3 or 6 or 8, of what they're not going to do for the next 50 years. And no one can know that. And when you hear it, don't you believe it. And you don't have to ever, ever apologize for hoping for and believing in your child.
Oh, that's so fabulous. I love that. And then, you know, as much autism as there is out there now, there's still a lot of parents of children who don't have autism, but still I found that the whole principles and the approach with the Sunrise program are applicable to any parent. So what would you say to kind of your average parent out there not dealing with autism but wanting to raise their child, you know, as best they can? What advice do you have based on the principles of the Sunrise program that could help all parents?
Well, that's a great question. And as you point out, you know, we work with a whole host of parents also in a separate program that's called the parenting program, actually, that doesn't have to do with autism. For parents just raising their kids, trying to do the best they can and having the challenges that parents have with that. And so a couple of things. Number one, just a reminder of what we talked about earlier, that your child is not a reflection of you. Doesn't mean you don't love and want to help them, but what they do doesn't tell you anything about you as a parent, good or bad. And secondly, is when we have this program called the parenting program, it's interesting because we focus on these three areas, which are called love, guide, and let go. And as you can probably guess, Eleanor, that third step is the hardest for most parents.
It is. It was for me.
Yeah. So we talk about loving, not just loving your child, which every parent does, but with really loving your child without need or requirement, really accepting them where they are while still having things you want to help them change about. And that's the guide part. We focus on ways to help them change that come from a place of real strength, but without a sense of neediness or push. And then thirdly, that piece, that let go piece, which is if you can do all the things that you want to do to try and help your child grow into the kind of person you want to help them be, but without requiring that they do that in order for you to feel okay about yourself and about them. Because like you said, every person, including your child, even if your child's six, they're doing the best they can based on what they know, and they're not doing that as an extension of you. They're just doing that as their own person, and there's lots of things you can do to help them, but there's nothing you can do to control them in their mind, as we all know. So
right.
that letting go part is really important.
Absolutely, and we're at a point now to take our break halfway through the program, but I want our listeners to know how else they can learn more about your work on autism. I know you've got a book coming out early next year. And how can people get in touch with the Autism Treatment Center of America?
Sure. Well, first of all, go to our website, which is www.autismtreatment.org. That's autismtreatment.org. There are so much resources on that site, a lot of free things. They can watch hour and a half webinars at no charge, which help talk a lot more than what we're able to do in this interview about principles they can use. They can see interviews with people. So definitely go to that website. Number two, if they dial our phone number, which is 1-714-2779, that's 1-800-714-2779, they can talk to someone. We have a bunch of program advisors who are on the phone who can actually spend a half an hour, answer questions about people's kids, really help them with that. And then lastly, they can also get the book, which is called Sunrise, S-O-N-R-I-S-E, Sunrise, The Miracle Continues by Barry Neal Kaufman, my dad, and that's on Amazon. They can read all about the specifics of my story and some other parents' stories as well.
Fantastic. We'll pause now for the break. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Ron Kaufman, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Ron Kaufman. We've been talking about how Ron completely recovered from profound autism and went on to graduate from an Ivy League college and become a speaker worldwide. Now I'd like to focus on how the principles that enabled you to succeed on this remarkable journey can be applied for people who are not dealing with autism. Ron, part of your organization is the Option Institute, which runs programs for regular, everyday people really unconnected with autism. And you teach how to overcome all sorts of life challenges using some of the underlying principles of the program that helped you and that have helped the other families dealing with autism. You know, first of all, what kinds of issues do people come to the Option Institute to address?
Oh, holy cow. It's such an array. I mean, everything from a diagnosis of cancer to the death of a loved one to going through a divorce. And sometimes things that don't sound as catastrophic as those things. Sometimes it's people who want to have a better relationship with their significant other or who are feeling really kind of stressed and burnt out at work and want some help with that. And certainly people struggling with depression and anxiety and sort of ongoing chronic things like that as well come to us.
Well, so how do some of the core principles that you were talking about regarding, you know, how to help the children and families dealing with autism, what are the core principles that you're using that you apply from helping the families dealing with autism to those kinds of other challenges that people face?
Well, that's a great question. And at the Option Institute, you know, we're coming from this position, which is what we see is helpful not only, of course, if you're facing a child with autism, but with any life challenge, big or small, is that it all starts with your own beliefs, your own perspectives on what's happening. We have this model called stimulus belief response, which is basically just means the stimulus, the stuff that happens to us, which is normally, we talk normally as if the things that happen to us kind of create our happiness. You made me angry when you said that to me. Mm-hmm. That me losing my job really made me upset or depressed. So we talk as if the things that are happening around us are kind of controlling what we think and how we feel. But what we see is that there's this key missing link in between what happens and how we feel, which is our belief about what happened, our perspective on what happened. You know, when I had autism, when I was diagnosed, everyone really tried to, not in a mean way, they were trying to be helpful, but they were ultimately trying to sell my parents this perspective of, this is a big tragedy, this is really terrible, your son has a really limited future. And what my parents decided to do before they created the Sunrise program, before I had progressed in any way, was they started with the position of, actually, we don't want to see him as a tragedy, we want to see him as a gift. We don't want to see his limitations, we want to see his possibilities. We don't want to decide right now that he is going to have a limited future. We want to decide his future is unwritten and limitless at this point. So a lot of this, and I know it can sound a little rah-rah when I say it like that, but it has very practical applications. Because when we're upset about something, remember, behind every response we have, every feeling we have, is a belief or a perspective. So when, if it's something simple, like our neurotypical child gets in trouble at school, right? Oftentimes we immediately, before we even react, we have this belief about it, which is, for instance, what my child did at school says something bad about me as a parent. Or if someone breaks up with us in a relationship, we think, you know, I'll never be happy again, or this means something about me not being attractive. We make up what stuff means all the time. And then we act as if that's just the factual truth, like this is just true, when in reality, it's just our made-up belief and perspective about it. It's a meaning that we've created. And the good news about that, this is what all of our programs at the Option Institute focus on, is we focus on first finding out what is that belief or perspective that's making this situation feel so hard. And then that belief is changeable. It's actually changeable, so you can replace it with something, just like my parents did when I was diagnosed, but so that you can replace it with something that creates a sense of focus and empowerment and deep comfort instead of fear or anxiety or frustration.
Wow. I think you just laid out for us right there kind of the key to a successful, happy life. You know, irrespective of autism, not autism, but for all of us, you know, so often we think of exactly what you're saying. We think of what's happening as if it's happening to us. But truly, we are at the center of our own lives. You know, and some people think we attract certain kinds of experiences in our lives. So, you know, maybe we do, maybe we don't. That would be hard to prove. But one thing we do know is that we can't control all the things that are happening around us. But we can absolutely control how we think about and how we feel about and how we respond to what's happening in us, whether that's a relationship that we're in with, you know, a spouse or a partner, a relationship with our child, or a job situation or a money situation. Whatever the situation is, we can take control of how we hold it, how we think about it, our beliefs about it, as you talk about, and then knowing that, that is what we can change, how we hold it, how we see it, and what we believe about it.
Absolutely. And it's so funny because the things that most people see as having, in quotes, brought them the most happiness or unhappiness, and when I talk about that, I'm talking about things like your significant relationship, your children, your job, your finances. Let's take those four things, since those are probably the four biggest things people sort of see as either bringing them great happiness or bringing them great unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that's true is that it's not that those things bring us happiness or unhappiness. It's that those four areas in particular are areas where we make what happens in those areas mean something really deep about who we are. So what happens in our relationship, what happens in our job, depending on who you are, what happens in terms of your finances and what your kids do, those areas we decide that either means we're a great parent, a great wife, a great husband, a great and competent person at work. We either decide that, or we decide, especially in this economy, if you're being laid off, I'm not useful, I'm not competent, or I'm not successful. And those things are completely self-produced, meaning it's not actually the getting the promotion or the getting laid off that causes those things. It's that what we make them mean. And this is why it's fascinating. When we have programs at the Option Institute, it still astounds me to this day that you can take the same stimulus, the same exact event, let's say someone getting a promotion at work, which should, if you would think and you weren't subscribing to our model, it should make everybody happy or everybody unhappy. But what happens in reality is you can take the same event, and we'll have people in our program who got promoted who feel wonderful about it, and other people in the same program who got a promotion and feel terrible or feel scared or feel guilty about the same thing. So this shows us that it's not actually the event at work here. It's the belief and the thing we're making the event mean in our mind.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of truth there. And, you know, I'm going to press on this point because I know there are so many people out there right now who are really hurting. They're hurting because they lost a job, they can't find another job, they lost the value in their homes. You know, one out of four homeowners are underwater. They owe more on their home than the value of the home. And lots of financial stress out there. So, and people can say, well, gee, that really sounds nice, but, you know, it's not my belief that's causing me to lose my home. It's because I had an illness, I had high medical bills, I couldn't work because I was sick, so I lost my house, now I'm broke, I'm in debt, and I'm really depressed about it. So someone could look at that and go, that's not about my beliefs, that's about these external situations with the economy and my health that I couldn't control. So what would you say to someone like that?
That is a completely fair question. And I can understand it completely. You know, I think it would be harder for someone to fully get this because they haven't been in a program for, let's say, a week with us where they're exploring it from all these avenues. But let me address that because I think probably a bunch of people are probably thinking exactly what you just said. And here's the thing. Of course, it's not that person's doing, let's say, that they got sick and then had medical bills and then got laid off, et cetera. Of course, we're not saying, I would never say, it's because you had a certain belief and that made all that stuff happen. No, that's exactly what you were referring to before, which is the stuff outside of ourselves that maybe we can't always control, for sure. Here's the thing that I would say to that person, though. No, they didn't cause what happened to them, but Now the only question that's of any value at this point is, let's say they're feeling stressed out or anxious or depressed. Do they want to feel differently about it? Would they like to? If there were a way that someone could help them, so that even as they're looking for a new job and even as they're trying to get back on their feet, in the meantime, they could actually feel better and feel more comfortable, which, by the way, will probably even make them more effective at getting the new job anyway. But if they want that, that's the part that we can help them with, and that's the part that I can just promise you, if you're listening, that part is changeable. It really is. It might not always feel that way. I get that. It's not like I've never been unhappy about anything. Of course, I get that feeling. But the one thing that I'm really grateful for, even just from my long history and teaching at the Option Institute and learning from my parents and all that, is not that now I'm immune to unhappiness and I never, ever, ever get unhappy. It's that even when I do get unhappy about something, I'm really aware that I'm the guy doing it. So I don't feel like it's happening to me and I'm a victim to it. I can sort of see that I'm doing it because of what I'm believing or thinking, and that I'm probably believing or thinking that for a good reason, but that gives me a way out. I can look at that. I can look at how I'm putting it together in my head, and that gives me a new way. And that's not just for things like losing your job. It's even for the most intense life challenges. You would think it would be impossible for someone to feel comfortable if their husband or wife, for instance, dies. Right?
Oh,
and
that's
we
a tough
work
one.
With people who are devastated over that. But we have actually seen people really come to a place of peace with that.
Really? And how do you bring someone from that deep level of grief to a place of peace?
Well, here's the thing. Firstly, they have to actually be interested in that. Like, we're not evangelists who go around trying to convince people to do stuff they don't want to do. Basically, someone's already coming to us because, let's say, someone they love died, and they're devastated. And they're coming to us in the first place because they're saying, I'm devastated, and I want to be in a different place with this. I know I can't change the fact that they died, but I would like to not be in such a deep place of misery about it. So they're already starting from this position of, I'd like to feel differently, I'd like to be in a different place, even though I don't necessarily have any idea how I could do that at this point. And that's the first place we start. And then the next thing we do is we ask, this is going to sound almost silly, but we actually start asking people non-directive questions. We have something called the Option Process Dialogue, which is this system of non-directive, very non-judgmental questions that help people really uncover what is the belief that's creating all that misery.
So you have a whole system that you go through that you can walk people through.
Come again?
You have a whole system that you walk people through when they come there.
Oh, yes, yes. And it starts with, it doesn't end with asking people questions, but it starts with asking people questions and asking questions about why they feel, the questions almost sound obvious at first. Why do you feel upset that you got laid off? Or why do you feel devastated that you don't have this person in your life? And usually the person's first answer is, well, what do you mean? Well, of course, duh, of course I feel that way because of X. And then we stay with that. We start asking a bunch of pretty incisive questions that get people to see that they actually feel the way they feel for a reason. And that actually it's doing something for them. Like, for instance, I'll just give you an example. Sometimes people, when they lose someone they love, they're feeling really upset and devastated is the only way they know how to keep feeling close to that person and honoring that person and keeping that person alive for themselves. There's nothing wrong with that. But one of the things they start to see is that there might be another way to stay close to that person and keep that person alive for yourself that doesn't entail doing it with your misery.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So, you know, I have had a lot of friends who really have gotten whacked with this economic downturn. And with the general climate, I think there's a lot of anxiety out there. We have, you know, the global climate change with the tornadoes and the tsunamis and, you know, the sense that the political system's just all messed up and paralyzed and only working for the top 1%. And then, you know, it takes the personal expression of people losing jobs or homes. So, you know, for example, I have a good woman friend of mine who was very well off, and then in the economy she lost not only her investment properties but also her own home. and she ended up, broke and in debt, without a job, without the resources she was used to, and, for the first time in her life, in her 60s, just struggling for economic survival. So what would you say if you were speaking directly to my friend?
Oh, well, actually, it sounds like she's really dealing with a lot. I mean, the first thing I would do is ask her some questions. Mm-hmm. But let me just say this, and this addresses to your friend, but also probably to a lot of other people listening, because you cited a whole array of things that I think a lot of people are concerned about. Mm-hmm. And this may sound a little funny, but I think we're really well schooled in fear. And that's what all the media are pumping. It's a big thing. I don't think that's going to come as a shock to anyone. I'm certainly not the first person to say that. But the difference is, for instance, we have a bunch of programs. Like, we have a program to help couples with their relationships. We have a program called Optimal Self-Trust on helping people make decisions. But when you were talking, I was thinking of this program we teach called Fearless. And it's basically all about how to look at and take apart all of our fears so that we can really move beyond them. And the first thing to understand is that all fear is rational, not irrational. It's actually almost like it's a life strategy that we use to take care of ourselves, because that's what we're taught to do. And it's all, interestingly
enough...
Wait a minute.
What about the reptilian brain that's supposed to be like the base of our brain, and that's kind of a fear response? You don't think that's true?
Well, it's interesting, right? There's the part of the brain called the amygdala.
Yep.
And if you look up what the amygdala actually does, it's often called the fear center of the brain.
Right.
But what it actually does is it screens for threats. And I'm getting a little into semantics here, but I do want to say that that is actually different than fear. Being able to see, I got to take care of myself here, or something could potentially injure me here, is really different than feeling an emotional sense of ongoing anxiety and ongoing fear about something, which is actually a very human thing. Snakes don't go around in a state of deep anxiety throughout the day and need to go on Prozac. That's a human thing. So the thing is that's why what we see, and I see this personally when I'm working with people in the Fearless program itself, is I watch how people use fear as a way to motivate themselves,
right,
as a way to protect themselves, because they're afraid if they're not scared, they're going to do something to hurt themselves. Also, it's really interesting how each instance of fear is precipitated by a fear-generating question. So people ask themselves questions that are very biased, like, who's out to get me? How can this hurt me? How might I mess this up? So they already are asking questions that are leading them down a road toward freakout. And I understand that. That's what we're taught to do. But there's another way to do it. One of the first things that we talk about in that program helping people is to do a few steps first. And I would say this to your friend if I were talking to her. First thing is, you got to take ownership for the fear, meaning instead of saying this fear is happening to me, the first thing you have to say is, this isn't happening to me, the fear. I'm actually making this. I'm creating the fear. Even if you don't know how to solve it yet, that's the first thing. The next thing is to actually change the question you're asking yourself, meaning to actually, instead of saying, how is this going to hurt me? How is this going to have long-term bad consequences? To start changing the question. What can I do to help myself here? How am I going to be laughing about this later? What am I going to learn from this? Even just changing the question starts to change our mindset about it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is fear is an obsession with what we don't want. So a lot of times, simply stopping obsessing about what we don't want and flipping it to focus on what we do want can be really helpful. So instead of saying, I don't want to get fired, saying, I want to be successful here even is different. Instead of saying, I don't want my marriage to dissolve, we can say, I really want my marriage to be warm and loving and successful. So, like, we can say different kinds of things instead of this bias that we're taught to have. And once we start to change the bias, we start to have a bias toward fearlessness instead of fear.
Wow, it sounds like we should all take that course called Fearlessness. I totally agree with you. I think we have a completely fear-based society, and I think some of it gets stoked by people who want us to spend gazillions of dollars on the weapon systems, but it's
yes,
not only just in the military, but it's, it's at every layer of our lives there's so much fear. And what you're doing gives people a way through and a way out and a way beyond that fear into a place of peace and a place of joy. So, Ron, how can listeners get in touch with the Option Institute?
Okay, so it's just great. Thank you for asking. First of all, let me just spell it because a lot of people have the name wrong, although you're saying it correctly. It's the Option Institute, O-P-T-I-O-N, singular. There's no S at the end there. The Option Institute. And the website is super simple. It's www.optionoption.org. O-P-T-I-O-N.org. That's it. And actually, the phone number is kind of a fun phone number. They can dial 1-800-71-HAPPY. That is actually the phone number, 1-800-71-HAPPY. And oh, one last thing. Last time I was recommending that book that my dad wrote called Sunrise, the Miracle Continues. What they can do if they want to just apply this to their life in general is get a book. It's really just a simple, quick read. It's called Happiness is a Choice. It's also by my father, Barry Neal Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N. And Happiness is a Choice gives a bunch of really quick shortcuts to becoming more comfortable and at peace, even in the face of life challenges.
I love that book, Happiness is a Choice. I actually have read it many times. And one Christmas, I bought a whole box of them, and I gave them out to my friends and family.
Oh, my gosh.
And I can almost tell who's read it and who hasn't.
That's really funny.
I highly recommend Happiness is a Choice. It's a fantastic book. And my last question before we close out here today is, Ron, you know that my work for years has been searching for the breakthrough solutions that show a way forward in the seemingly impossible problems, but that actually we have solutions to virtually all of these problems. Someone somewhere has those solutions. And I can see in my mind's eye the kind of society we'd be living in if we would actually identify and build on these breakthrough solutions instead of accepting the limitations of the current kind of mainstream approaches. So I just want to get your take on how possible do you think it is to be looking for these breakthrough solutions in different fields, like you've created one here in autism and then applied it more broadly. How possible do you think it is to identify and build on these breakthrough solutions to create the kind of world we really want to live in?
Oh, well, let me tell you this. I mean, first of all, I'm so glad that you wrote that book. I mean, that book is so important. And I feel like it's this weird combination of obvious and deeply, deeply not obvious. Because what ends up, there are all these solutions, exactly what you said, that are already out there, like what we're doing and like all the things featured in your book that address things that we see as these intractable problems. And the thing, this comes back to what we're often taught in terms of our belief systems and fear-based beliefs, which is we're taught the solutions are either out there in some expert's hands that we can't access, or even worse, there just aren't solutions. These just aren't solvable problems. And what you show us in Breakthrough Solutions, and what I absolutely think is possible, is that these solutions are already happening. They're already existing. You've probably heard that quote, the person who believes that something is impossible should get out of the way of the person doing it.
I love that.
Yes, and this is the thing. This is so doable, but we have to be starting from this point of view of this is something we can actually do. These things are already happening. If we're starting from this position of it's just not doable, then we're not even going to look for the solutions that are already out there.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have. I'm sorry to say we could go on for years, I'm sure. And Ron Kaufman, thank you so much for coming on this program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Eleanor.
You can read more about Ron Kaufman and the Sunrise Program in my book, Breakthrough Solutions, How to Improve Your Life and Change the World by Building on What Works, available now only at thebreakthroughway.com. In case you've missed any of these programs on radio, they're available in the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com, PRN.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Ronnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest, Marcia Beauchamp, U.S. Education Manager at Tony Blair Faith Foundation. I'll be back in 2 weeks from today with another guest to talk about breakthrough solutions.